from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, we'll discuss the latest news out of the Middle East and take stock of new Israeli airstrikes in the Gaza Strip, which Israel's military says is in response to fresh rocket fire. We'll also talk about the ongoing surge of ISIS and the changeovers in government in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then at 9:30, an indictment with wide range of effects was handed down yesterday by a federal grand jury against the Petaluma slaughterhouse. We'll discuss the case. And we'll find out what it means. Join us for Forum. It's up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Israel has announced that it has launched airstrikes in the Gaza Strip in response to fresh rocket fire, and this just hours before a ceasefire was set to expire. Meanwhile, in Iraq, Islamic extremists claim that they control the Mosul Dam, which supplies the power and water to surrounding areas. But President Obama said yesterday that Iraqi troops and Peshmerga fighters have retaken the dam. The carnage under ISIS and in Syria continues, and new government leadership is taking shape in Iraq and Afghanistan. We want to discuss the latest news out of the Middle East. And joining us to do that this morning in this half hour is Dan Murphy, staff reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He's with us from New Jersey. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also say good morning to John Danishevsky, who is also with us this morning by phone from New York. He's vice president and senior managing editor for international news with the Associated Press. And good to have you with us, John Danishevsky.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, and thank you for joining us. And I want to talk, of course, about a number of issues here with both of you gentlemen, and I should say that the United Nations Agency for Refugees is also launching a major aid operation to reach more than 500,000 people displaced by fighting in northern Iraq. I'm wondering at this point, well, let's hear first actually what President Obama said about the Mosul Dam.
Today, with our support, Iraqi and Kurdish forces took a major step forward by recapturing the largest dam in Iraq near the city of Mosul. The Mosul Dam fell under terrorist control earlier this month and is directly tied to our objective of protecting Americans in Iraq. If that dam was breached, it could have proven catastrophic, with floods that would have threatened the lives of thousands of civilians and endanger our embassy compound in Baghdad.
That, again, was President Obama speaking yesterday about the retaking, or what appears to be the retaking, of the Mosul Dam. Of course, Dan Murphy, it's kind of hard to get reporters in there to know exactly what's going on moment to moment, but have we turned possibly a smaller corner here with ISIS, particularly in light of the aerial bombardments that are going on not only there but in Syria?
I'd be very reluctant to draw that conclusion based on what amounts to some pinprick aerial support. The Iraqi military has proven itself to be essentially not really a military at all over the past few months. The Peshmerga, which a lot of people knew that their reputation was vastly, which were the Kurdish fighters, was vastly overdone, have also been shown to not be all they were cracked up to be. And whether or not some limited American air support helped them retake the Mosul Dam at the moment, that's a very different thing from being able to hold it. And if anybody thinks that the so-called Islamic State, as they like to be called, our JV team, instead of a very capable military force now with very senior former Iraqi army officers driving the bus, they're going to be in for a big surprise.
Yeah, John Danishevsky, the conclusion that one can draw from this is that holding territory is a lot more, shall we say, formidable and challenging than actually taking the territory. I mean, that goes for both sides. But what Dan Murphy just said about the Iraqi army is, of course, illustrative here of what's been failing. Is there going to be any change with the change in government with Malachi ousted?
Well, I think there's a chance for a kind of a reboot. It's going to be hard because the Iraqi army, as currently constituted, is a heavily Shiite force supported by Shiite militias. They haven't succeeded in broadening the base of the army very effectively. And what we've seen over the past several months is the Iraqi army per se feels much more comfortable holding and fighting in Shiite areas and defending Shiite shrines than extending deep into the Sunni heartland, which Mosul and that whole arc along down to Fallujah and Ramadi and to Crete.
Well, there's been talk from our government about a new reboot, as you call it, possibly hastening more inclusion of, well, Sunnis, frankly, but also the former Baathists. And Malachi seemed much more secularized than that, excuse me, much more divided than that. And can we hope at least for some kind of reboot that would include more inclusiveness?
I think that they're definitely going to try. It's going to be a challenge because they had the Sunni awakening forces before who before felt they were betrayed and abandoned, and now you have to try to bring those people back in. The factor that could help is, of course, a lot of these Baathist and Sunni tribes are not that comfortable or happy with the Islamic State fighters and the brand of Islam that they perpetuate. And, of course, a lot of the big foreign backers in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia, also would be throwing their weight against Islamic State.
And again, John Danishevsky with us, Vice President, Senior Managing Editor for International News with the Associated Press. Dan Murphy is Staff Reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Let me turn to recent events that are going on with respect to Israel and Gaza with you, Dan Murphy. There was a five-day ceasefire extended. Apparently it was broken by Hamas sending rockets into Israel and Israel striking back with aerial force. And now it turns out that an Israeli official says Prime Minister Netanyahu has ordered negotiators at ceasefire talks to return home from Cairo following this rocket fire. This just gets worse, doesn't it?
It might be. I mean, to be honest, the notion that there would be some kind of durable solution out of the talks in Cairo was always nonsense. It was never going to happen because you had two parties who won't even sit in the same room together. Both of whom, one side has a very long and specific list of demands, and the other side, he said, we're not going to meet any of them, no matter what. And that's basically been the way it's been for a while. A little bit of rocket fire today, a little bit of Israeli retaliation. It's not good, and we could see a return to really open hostilities, but it's also possible that both sides will be more restrained, at least for the next few months, and we will see kind of these small flare-ups here and there, but it won't be kind of the real serious bombardment of Gaza that we were seeing a month ago.
Could you say something, Dan Murphy, about the role of Egypt as an honest broker in this? Because Egypt, according to what I read, detests Hamas perhaps as much as Israel.
Perhaps more. Hamas is an outgrowth, of course, although they're different organizations, but its roots lie with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the Islamist movement that won the presidency fair and square in Egypt. A coup was carried out against them a little over a year ago to bring back essentially a military order to run the country. Sisi is at the top of that. He outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood, and he would like nothing more than to see Hamas destroyed. When you're quite right, what that means is any notion that Egypt is going to be seen as an even-handed friend to both sides or friend to neither in any kind of a process is nonsense. But again, that almost doesn't matter because there just seems to be no evidence that there is any willingness to compromise from either Hamas or from Israel.
Well, it would seem, John Danishevsky, that not only is there no compromise, but when you look at these 11 points that have been discussed in Cairo, essentially getting agreement by Israel to lift the blockade, or for that matter, to Egypt to lift its blockade, or getting agreement to demilitarize Hamas in Gaza, seem almost at this point like pipe dreams. Where are we going to get some kind of cessation of hostilities to anything even approaching an agreement?
Yes, the sort of narrow margin for a compromise might be additional role for Fatah, which is the rival to Hamas in the Palestinian territories. And if you could sort of get Fatah controlling the border with Egypt or international guarantees for weapons, I think there's just a very, very narrow opening for some kind of compromise. Essentially, both sides, Hamas and Israel, want to feel that they gain something from this this fighting, and so each will be looking for a sort of a face saving. The people in Gaza, of course, need reconstruction. They need a chance to recover from this horrible trauma, and there is the carrot is a massive infusion of aid money to help Gaza rebuild.
It's kind of strange to think, though, that Hamas's actions are to some extent governed by Khalid Mashal, who is political bureau head of Hamas, who is sitting in a 5-star hotel in Qatar. I mean, dictating essentially what's going on at, I don't know if you call it a negotiating table, but at least a place where they're talking about these 11 points.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he's outside. He has a sanctuary there. He's and he is the most biggest political leader that Hamas has right now. But I think, as I say, I think the Fatah factor might come into play here.
Well, there was a unity government. In fact, all this broke out after Fatah or Abu Mazen made what appeared to be some kind of unification with the forces in Gaza, the Hamas forces in Gaza. Let me open the phone lines. This is a half-hour segment, and consequently, those of you who would like to chime in here or have something to offer in the conversation, questions or comments, would be advised to call now. Our toll-free number is available, and you can call us at that number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement in the program, and feel free to call now. 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And I want to go right to your calls and emails here forthwith, but we want to cover a lot of regional, concerns, let's put it that way. And I wanted to just bring Afghanistan in here because despite the Taliban and despite what's been going on there, we do have another new government and the Karzai government being replaced. In fact, we have a unity government. And Dan Murphy, some are thinking that this looks a little more sanguine, whereas, you know, President Obama's war was in Afghanistan and not in Iraq. He's getting criticized for pulling troops out of Iraq, and things are maybe looking a little up for Afghanistan, or are they?
You must forgive me. If there was news today about a unity government in Afghanistan, it's news to me.
Well, there's movement toward that unity government. I should have
phrased it. Yes. Certainly John Kerry went one time to Kabul and got them to agree to do it. That wheels fell off of that in about a day and a half. So then he went back a couple of weeks later, which is about a week ago, and got them agree to do the same thing again. And it looked to me like the wheels were coming off of that within about a day and a half as well. Basically, we have a contested election between Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani. Kerry has been trying to carve out a role, it seems, for Abdullah in a Ghani administration after Karzai steps down. But there, again, has been very little compromise from either men so far. And while, unlike most instances, the United States has enormous amounts of leverage in Afghanistan because they're so heavily reliant on us financially, they're still actually in a very perilous state. And I don't want to be pessimistic, but I see no particular reason for great optimism about what's about to happen there.
And yet there have been a lot of photo ops between these two contesting the election and talking, at least rhetorically, about the fact that they can come together or that they maybe even will come together, that they both have not only Afghanistan's interests at heart, but also are willing, unlike Karzai, to work with the United States.
I mean, sure, I think both men are going to be, you know, probably would work the United States, and I think, you know, eventually I think the Afghans are going to give something like a status of forces agreement that will allow American troops to stay. You know, however, I'll just give you a for instance. Kerry goes, he gets both sides to agree that there's going to be the creation of this kind of executive position for whoever loses the presidential election. It's going to be kind of like a prime minister. It's going to end this disastrous, frankly, enormous centralization of power in a kind of unchecked presidency that we gave to Afghanistan over the past 10 years. And then a day later, Ghani says, nah, I'm actually not going to do that. So, you know, they everybody's happy to shake and smile for the cameras, but, you know, that's basically just to keep Kerry happy and the Americans on side when they're in country.
I want to bring our callers in, but first, John Danishevsky, agree with, well, that sort of guarded pessimism you're hearing from your colleague, Dan Murphy?
Yeah, I'm a little more optimistic. I was in Afghanistan a few weeks ago, and I spoke to both of them, and they're both very concerned that that Afghanistan not become what Iraq is right now, and they say they've seen that sort of hell already, and they don't want Afghanistan to return to it. And I think they're both sincere in wanting to work together. Of course, it's very contentious. You have these two communities who both feel entitled and want to come out of the election again as winners. And so there has to be some sort of meaningful role for Abdullah in the government. And even if he's willing to compromise, it's a problem with some of his followers. So, but I'm a little bit more optimistic because I think they've been to the abyss and the brink and they have looked over and they don't like what they see.
Talking about Iraq and Afghanistan, also talking about Israel and Gaza and new events that have occurred and new events that are ongoing, and we welcome your calls. You can join us now at 866-733-6786. And let's begin with Lou. Lou, you're on.
All right. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a question for your guests. Both Hamas and Islamic State are rooted in the old Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood with Saeed Qutb and Hassan al-Banna. There are jihadist states. They're genocidal toward many groups, particularly Jews and other non-Muslims. And they get their funding from more or less the same places. Are there anything that can be learned? Is there anything that can be learned in fighting both Hamas and Islamic State from seeing the bigger picture?
Your caller's assertion is false for a starting point. Hamas and the so-called Islamic State are not the same thing. They don't have the same ideological or historical antecedents and don't really have the same funding mechanisms. So I don't know what else to say except that.
They are viewed, however, by the West as terrorists. Hamas is still labeled as terrorist, and certainly the ISIS state, whatever you want to call it, the new caliphate, as they'd like to be called, are also very much
sure, but the
genocidal and jihadi, like the caller said.
The IRA was branded terrorists by the UK. It doesn't mean it's the same thing as Al-Qaeda. The fact that people say that they're a terrorist doesn't actually tell you anything very important about their fundamental and core beliefs.
Well, let's talk about that just for a moment with you, Dan Murphy, because the fundamental and core belief of ISIS appears to be the destruction of anyone who is not a Sunni Muslim or a fundamentalist Sunni Muslim, although they will welcome conversions, apparently, but behead those who do not convert, whereas Hamas mainly wants to destroy Israel, I guess.
Well, Hamas wants to have a Palestinian state that has national goals, certainly would like to govern it based on its version of Sharia law. They've backed away from the talk about destruction of Israel since 2006. I'm not saying they're lovely people, but they have very national and specific goals and are a very kind of modern political movement in that sense. And, you know, the head choppers of the Islamic State, they want to restore what they imagine to be a golden age of Islamic governance from, 1,400 years ago or so. Their ambitions are limitless. Their dream is to control the whole world. They won't be able to do that, of course. But they are kind of true fanatics. And they will press and press and press. And as you say, they're quite happy to kill anybody that gets in their way. And they're a profoundly different kind of organization and a profoundly different kind of problem than a group like Hamas.
Well, and on the other hand, John Danishevsky, Hamas still has it in its charter that, yes, they want a Palestinian state, but they also want Israel to be out, gone. In fact, they want essentially not only to defeat, but to destroy Israel.
They have that in their charter, but I think if you spoke with them, they have all sorts of caveats and talk about a 50-year truce with Israel and so on. So, you know, I think I'm a little bit with Dan here that Hamas, while it has definitely an Islamic political coloring, is not in the same nihilistic frame of mind as the Islamic State.
Doesn't want to kill Yazidis or take women into slavery sexually like, say, Boko Ratan or ISIS. There are distinctions, certainly. Let me get to another caller, and that's Boko Haram, yeah. Jay is on the line with us. Jay, you're on.
Hi, good morning. So
morning.
I believe there is a old UN resolution for the borders of Israel and Palestine that was approved by United Nations and that has never been implemented. So why doesn't the U.S. and the Western Europeans using their military and financial muscle implement the UN resolution? Of course, we went to war on Iraq for not implementing UN resolution. So why don't we implement this? This is a peace resolution, actually. So why don't we implement that so there will be two separate states and there doesn't have to be any more negotiations between the two, because the UN resolution is very clear in what needs to be done to enforce two independent states and they can live at peace.
Well, you bring up, Jay, the whole matter of just how efficacious the United Nations is in any way, but John Danishevsky, you want to respond to essentially the pith of what the caller raised here?
Well, I think there's been so much history under the dam since those resolutions are passed, but I think the two-state solution has been the basis for negotiations for these past years, and the so-called Green Line is more or less where the UN also would have drawn the line, I guess, with some variations. So I think that peace process, if it gets revived, would probably be along something like that. But you've had now generations growing up with the reality on the ground now, and it's kind of hard to just to revert back to those original resolutions.
Yeah, I want to mention an email here from a listener who sent us a photo of a woman at a Kurdish rally holding a sign that reads, "There is a humanitarian crisis in Kurdistan, but nobody cares because they can't blame Israel." It's part of the problem with the United Nations and this part of the world, Dan Murphy, is there's very, very little trust in Israel where the United Nations is concerned.
Very little trust from Israel, yeah.
From Israel, yeah.
The United Nations doesn't have an army of its own. It has its functions, but the UN resolutions aren't really binding in any kind of powerful and important way. And the dream of two states along the 1968 borders has been dying for a long time. It continues to die for a long time. I certainly don't see an external power enforcing any kind of change in that status quo anytime soon.
Well, but
by the way, I will just say the thing about the Kurds, and nobody cares about the Kurds.
Yeah.
It's getting enormous amounts of attention and assistance and media coverage. And for goodness sakes, the United States is bombing Iraq to help the Kurds.
I would just add one thing to your sense of another. I mean, if the United Nations or the EU were driven in some way to take a major role in terms of Israeli security and ensuring with a two-state solution that that security could be ensured, well, that's a big order, I realize. They're going to have to end it there. Dan Murphy, thank you so much for joining us. Dan Murphy is a staff reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. And John Danishevsky, thank you, Vice President and Senior Managing Editor for International News with Associated Press. When we return, we'll talk about yesterday's indictment against the slaughterhouse in Petaluma. I'm Michael Krasny.